Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. Before I begin the April 2026 issue, I'll be concluding Child's Play, Tech's New Generation, and The End of Thinking by Sam Criss from the March 2026 issue. The article resumes with an interview with Chungin Roy Lee, who is the 21-year-old founder of Cluely.com. Also present at this interview is a man with the pseudonym Donald Boat. Donald Boat, through his unrelenting posts on social media with very well-known and highly successful tech entrepreneurs, has been richly rewarded for his goading. There were still some things I didn't understand about Roy. He was clearly a highly agentic person, but what was all this agency being used for? What did he actually want? According to Roy, he has three great aims in life: to hang out with friends, to do something meaningful, and to go on lots of dates. He said he went on a date every 2 weeks, which was clearly meant to be an impressive figure. Cluely employees are encouraged to date a lot. They can put it all on expenses. They didn't seem to be taking up the opportunity to any greater degree than their founder. I spoke to Cameron White, who had been Roy and Neil's first hire at the company. As he spoke, he stared at a point roughly 45 degrees to my left and swung his arms. He didn't date. I'm focused on becoming a better version of myself first, becoming like higher weight, more healthy, more knowledgeable. He didn't think he had anything to offer a woman yet. I said that if someone loves you, they don't really care so much about your weight. I feel like that's cope. I don't think there's such a thing as love. It's what you can provide to a woman. If you can provide good genetics, that's health or whatever. If you can provide resources, if you can provide an interesting life, if you truly love the girl, you need to become the best version of yourself. Cameron was 25 years old, but he wasn't there yet. He would not try to meet someone until he had made himself perfect. For Roy, meanwhile, dating actually seemed to be a means to an end. All the culture here is downstream of my belief that human beings are driven by biological desires. We have a pull-up bar, and we go to the gym, and we talk about dating because nothing motivates people more than getting laid. He was interested in physical beauty too, but only because the better you look, the better you are as an entrepreneur. It's all connected, and beauty is everything. A lot of ugly men are just losers. The point of looking good is that society will reward you for that. What about other kinds of beauty? Music, for instance? Roy had played the cello as a child. Did he still listen to classical music? It doesn't get my blood rushing the same way that EDM will. His preferred genre was hardstyle, frantic thumping remixes of pop songs by the likes of Katy Perry and Taylor Swift. Is that the function of music to get your blood rushing? Yeah, I'm not a big fan of music to focus on things. I think it disturbs my flow. The only reason I will listen to music is to get me really hyped up when I'm lifting. The two possible functions of music were, apparently, focus and hype. Everything for the higher goal of building a successful startup. What about life itself? Would Roy die for Cluely? I would be happy dying at any age past 25. After that, it doesn't matter, bro. If I live, I have extreme confidence in my ability to make $3 million a year, every year, until I die. What about literature? The last time Donald had dropped in on his slaves at Cluely, he'd gifted them two Penguin classics, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales and Boccaccio's Decameron. The books were still lying, unread, where he'd left them. He suggested that Roy might find something more valuable than dying for Cluely if he actually tried to read them. Roy disagreed. I do not obtain value from reading books. And anyway, he didn't have the time. He was too busy keeping up with viral trends on TikTok. You have to make the time, Donald and I said, practically in unison. It makes your life better, I said. Why don't you go to Turkey to get a hair transplant? Roy snapped. That would make your life better. I don't care about my hair, I said. Well, said Roy, I don't care about the Decanterbury tales. Donald was practically vibrating when we left Cluely. "Dude, he's just a scared little boy," he said. "He's scared he's not doing the right thing, and because of the fucked up world we live in, people who should be in The Hague are giving him $20 million. Something bad is going to happen here. Something really fucking bad is going to happen." He sighed. "I just want Zorian's non-binary Praetorians to march across the country and put all these guys in cuffs." I found it hard to disagree. It did not seem like a good idea to me that some of the richest people in the world were no longer rewarding people for having any particular skills, but simply for having agency, when agency essentially meant whatever it was that was afflicting Roy Lee. Unlike Eric Xu, another young, very successful tech entrepreneur, or Donald Boat, Roy didn't really seem to have anything in his life except his own sense of agency. Everything was a means to an end, a way of fortifying his ability to do whatever he wanted in the world. But there was a great sucking void where the end ought to be. All he wanted, he'd said, was to hang out with his friends. I believed him. He wanted not to be alone, the way he'd been alone for a year after having his offer of admission rescinded by Harvard, for people to pay attention to him, to exist for other people. But instead of making friends the normal way, he'd walked up to strangers and asked whether they wanted to start a company with him, and then he built the most despised startup in San Francisco. He was probably right. He could count on making a few million dollars every year for the rest of his life, even after Cluely inevitably crashes and burns. He would never want for capital, but this did not seem like the most efficient way to achieve his goals. I walked back to my hotel, past signs that said things like "One ping, shipped, and AI agents are humans too." My scalp was tingling. I'd lied when I told Roy that I didn't care about my hair. Of course I care about my hair. Every day I grimace in the mirror as a little more of it vanishes from the top of my head. Whenever someone takes a photo of me from above or behind, I wince at the horrifying glimpse of pale, naked scalp. But I'd never done anything about it. I'd just watched and winged and let it happen. My encounter with the highly agentic took place last September. In October, Roy Lee spoke at something called TechCrunch Disrupt, where he admitted that chasing online controversy had so far failed to give Cluely what he called product velocity. Around the same time, he led a major rebrand. Cluely would now be in the business of making beautiful meeting notes and sending instant follow-up emails. A lot of these functions are already being introduced by companies like Zoom. The main difference is that, by all accounts, Cluely still doesn't consistently work. By the end of November, Cluely announced that it was leaving San Francisco and moving to New York. In December, the company celebrated the move with a party at a Midtown cocktail bar and lounge called No Flex. In photos, it appeared as though the gathering was attended almost entirely by men in white t-shirts not drinking anything. I was in New York at the time. I didn't go. Now, on to the April 2026 issue, starting with 38 Days of Ice, The Story of an Occupation, by Daniel Brook. For months, it seemed no one here in New Orleans was sleeping well. Every now and again, the president would fixate on our city, threatening to send in troops to clean it up. Then he'd back off. Long before Minneapolis, with its broad daylight slayings of American civilians, the worst-case scenarios had yet to materialize. Macabre possibilities haunted us at night, Pyrenean visions of dungeons and interrogation chambers. Just after Labor Day, seated by his gilded fireplace, President Trump briefly addressed the press. "We're making a determination now," he said. "Do we go to Chicago, or do we go to a place like New Orleans, where we have a great governor, Jeff Landry, who wants us to come in?" In the end, he chose Chicago and launched Operation Midway Blitz, a winking reference to either the Bears' defense line or Hitler's bombardment of London, maybe both. The Windy City's misfortune was the Crescent City's reprieve. But our respite proved short-lived. The week before Thanksgiving, leaked Department of Homeland Security documents disclosed that 250 Border Patrol agents would soon be on their way to New Orleans to supplement locally based ICE officers. The documents outlined a two-month-long crackdown aimed at making 5,000 arrests. Accompanying the masked troops would be ample materiel, thousands of pounds of tear gas and pepper spray balls, what the DHS called less lethal munitions, to deploy against the activists expected to oppose the occupation. Forces were scheduled to arrive in early December, as the Chicago land deployment was winding down. According to the leaked plans, the Louisiana mission would be called Operation Swamp Sweep, Operation SS. Allegedly, we were being targeted because of New Orleans' status as one of the country's 18 sanctuary cities. This sounded dubious. With more than three-quarters of its residents born in-state, Louisiana was low on migrants from the United States, let alone foreign countries. Was it retaliation for the city's daring to elect a Mexican-born Democrat, Elena Moreno, as mayor that fall? Or did the president enjoy the prospect of taking on a blue city in a red state, where Landry, a Republican, now also the U.S. Special Envoy to Greenland, would have the feds back? Or was it just a manifestation of Trump's petulant grudge against the city, where his plans to build a 70-story hotel and condominium building, announced the day before Hurricane Katrina struck, had imploded over a decade ago? In late November, I asked my friend Willem, who teaches social studies at a middle school with a large Latino population, what I might do to help. Here is footnote number one. To protect citizen activists, certain last names have been withheld. Willem's school was expecting many of its students to shelter in place with their families for the duration of the deployment under the protective canopy of the Fourth Amendment's guarantees against unreasonable search and seizure. Willem suggested that I sign up to deliver meals. I was impressed that the community had a food delivery system ready to go, but I wanted to do something confrontational, like trail ICE agents around town and loudly assert my First Amendment right to yell at masked goons. He had no leads on that, so I duly filled out an online form to volunteer time delivering meals. But as my access to a car was severely limited on weekdays, I suspected that I wouldn't be a prime candidate. I never heard back. I took some guilty solace in assuming that federal sweeps would primarily target New Orleans suburbs, where most of the region's Latino population lives, far from my urban neighborhood. But a raid on the first day of the operation, now rechristened Catahoula Crunch after the state's official dog, suggested otherwise. At 10:30 on the morning of Wednesday, December 3rd, Border Patrol agents descended on the parking lot of my local Lowe's. I'd shopped there innumerable times for mundane home improvement projects, and now there it was on the national news, brimming with masked men toting firearms. Later that day, Gregory Bovino was spotted on Williams Boulevard, the main commercial strip in Kenner, the city's most heavily Latino suburb. Then the commander-at-large of the Border Patrol, Bovino, was already infamous from his starring role in deployments in Los Angeles and Chicago. With his tough talk, squeaky voice, diminutive stature, and penchant for fascist fashion, he was a roving, live-action crisis of masculinity, a perfect avatar of the second Trump administration. For New Orleans Latino residents, his presence was terrifying. At Willem's school, attendance cratered. Many locals, whatever their immigration status, hunkered down at home to avoid encountering well-armed, poorly trained federal agents. At a friend's office, an American-born Latina colleague had begun commuting to work with her passport. To protect employees and customers, some Latino-owned businesses had closed shop the week before the surge. As the agents arrived, restaurateurs who kept their establishments open asked their non-Latino customers, who were less likely to be pulled over by immigration agents in nakedly discriminatory Kavanaugh stops, to dine out in support. I picked a Mexican restaurant in River Ridge, a working-class suburb hard up against the Mississippi, calling ahead to make sure it was open. On the drive out, the streets of New Orleans were barren. The weather was unusually chilly and dreary, as if nature itself were in revolt against the Border Patrol. When I arrived at the restaurant, I found the windows dark and the parking lot deserted. The entrance was locked, but I knocked anyway, and soon a waiter peered through the fogged-over glass. He cracked the door, let me in, then promptly shut and relocked it. From the looks of the kitchen, the restaurant seemed to be doing some delivery business, but the dining room was completely empty. The bright, cheery room, decorated with technicolor serapes and paintings of idyllic tropical village scenes, felt almost like a taunt. The waiter seemed to be struggling to muster a sense of normalcy. I avoided mentioning what we were surely both mulling. As I ate my chile relleno, I struggled to reckon with how things had gotten so bad so fast in New Orleans, in America. It felt like dining in a police state, worse in some ways. Reporting years ago in Bashar al-Assad, Syria, before the Civil War, I counted on the warmth of the cafes. The consolation of an evening mint tea and hookah was precious to those stalked by fear all day. Tonight, as I picked at a basket of tortilla chips, there was no such relief. After paying at the counter, I dropped some cash into the tip jar. The waiter accompanied me to the door, peering through the glass to scan for agents before unlocking it to let me out. As I headed into the night, I heard the lock click behind me. Over their first 8 days in Louisiana, federal immigration agents arrested 250 people. The raids appeared to be wildly unsystematic. More than 90% of those detained had no criminal record. The particular locations that were hit sounded as if the Border Patrol had taken tips from racist jokes overheard at a middle school. On December 9th, the feds raided an actual taco truck in Livingston Parish and detained two people. Local Democratic politicians were strangely quiescent, despite a pre-Catahoula Crunch poll showing that nearly 80% of New Orleans residents opposed the deployment. On the first day of the operation, Moreno requested that agents remove their masks and start focusing on criminals, but stopped short of asking them to leave. The following day, the city's Democratic congressman, Troy Carter, sent a letter to Bovino requesting federal transparency, due process protections, and humanitarian enforcements to ensure that Operation Catahoula Crunch proceeds in a manner worthy of the people of New Orleans. The New Orleans City Council, all Democrats, did little beyond posting Know Your Rights information online in English, Spanish, and Vietnamese to inform residents that, under the Fourth Amendment, they had a right to remain safely in their homes unless federal agents presented them with a warrant signed by a judge. The council, astonishingly, also instructed every adult U.S. citizen in the city to carry your papers with you at all times. Even as activists smarted over the capitulation of the city's Democratic establishment, they were well prepared for this moment. That first week, activists canvassed businesses in Latino neighborhoods, offering bilingual printouts reading "Everyone is welcome here except ICE." The posters, soon ubiquitous, specified that non-public areas, offices, kitchens, break rooms, were not open to inspection without a warrant. Shortly thereafter, an activist invited me to join a neighborhood ICE watch group called Ojos, Eyes, in Spanish. All it took was attending a 90-minute training session that the group was holding that weekend. On Saturday, I biked over to an Episcopal church in my neighborhood to join up. Seated in the pews, we were a diverse assemblage of races, ages, and countries of origin. A pair of organizers stood up front and began a tag team presentation. Aaron, a lanky public defender and former college football kicker, let off. "What can we do constitutionally to record the agents and alert our neighbors?" he asked, the low wintertime sun streaming in through a stained glass window. His sidekick, Rob, a nationally touring musician with a voluminous mane of dark frizz, provided the answer. "It's always legal to film law enforcement in public spaces, even though they really don't like to be documented." Aaron noted that it would, however, be a crime to impede an officer. "A simple rule could keep us safe, both legally and physically. Don't be somewhere an officer can touch you, and don't touch an officer." In some respects, New Orleans was unusually well-equipped to counter a Border Patrol deployment. The local immigrant community first began organizing after Hurricane Katrina, most often to confront shady building contractors who were stiffing their undocumented employees. These efforts increased amid the intensified immigration enforcement of the first Trump administration, and now they were scaling up once again. Last summer, when police departments in New Orleans' suburban parishes, which had long collaborated with ICE, began setting up traffic checkpoints in Latino neighborhoods, documented community members soon found themselves thrust into activist roles. Alejandra, a Spanish-language radio DJ who had for years posted community events, news, and real-time weather alerts on her Facebook page, Explosion Latina NOLA, was now helping relatives of ISIS captives navigate its detainee database. The creator of Ojos, for her part, was a hotel bartender named Rachel. As she explained to me, the group operated on a remarkably simple principle. Freedom of speech allows us to say, "I see ICE here." Aaron emphasized that the key to good reporting was precision. "We'd never just post, 'ICE is on Chef Montour,'" he said, referring to Chef Montour Highway, which extends for nearly 3 miles through Central American and Southeast Asian enclaves. A post that vague would terrify undocumented community members without providing actionable information. Specifying the exact intersection where federal agents are spotted, the exact time they're seen, and what time they leave, on the other hand, could enable undocumented residents to make informed decisions about whether to venture from their homes to go to the grocery store, head to a doctor's appointment, or leave for work. Rob explained that in the Ojos WhatsApp chat, possible sightings are first marked investigando, investigating. If and when it becomes clear that immigration enforcement is actually occurring, confirmado, confirmed, and then once agents have left, despejado, all clear. Aaron also offered tips on identifying the unmarked vehicles favored by ICE and the Border Patrol. The agents work in pairs, so there's typically someone riding shotgun. Most agents, he said, drive large, late-model, American-made SUVs like Ford Expeditions and Chevy Suburbans with deeply tinted windows. The Buy American Act requires federal agencies to purchase vehicles manufactured in the United States. Of course, in Louisiana, with its cheap, abundant, and locally refined gasoline, many civilians drive these behemoths too. So at school pickups, organizers ask parents to roll their windows down and blast music, something that joyless agents would never do. Once the sighting is confirmed, Ojos leaders upload unmarked cars' license plate numbers to a national bilingual database at icecheck.org. Activists told me that plates moved with the agents. Tags identified during an earlier deployment in North Carolina were now being spotted in Louisiana. Immigration agents, seemingly aware that their plates were being tracked, took to installing license plate covers that made them difficult to read and photograph, or to driving with no plates at all. Plate covers are illegal in Louisiana and many other states. Plateless driving is illegal nationwide. Faced with a well-organized community, agents' attempts at anonymity were useless. Their unmarked cars weren't fooling anyone. Before leaving the church that day, Aaron and Rob had us rehearse how we might protect a school bus stop from an immigration raid. This was the type of everyday resistance that parents at Willem School had been mounting for weeks. I opted to play an ICE agent and found myself genuinely flustered when those role-playing the parents refused to answer my stone-faced queries about their immigration status and which hospital they were born in. There was little I could legally do in response. When the training at the church wrapped up, we each scanned a QR code to be added as ICE watchers on the WhatsApp chat. I was assigned to Ojos Alerts 2, since the original Ojos Alerts was already full. WhatsApp caps its group chats at 1,024 members. Just over 2 weeks into the occupation, New Orleans already had more than 1,000 civilians watching the Border Patrol and ICE in a modest-sized metro area of 1 million people. And as the community mobilized, the pace of arrests began to slow. During the second week of the occupation, federal immigration agents arrested 120 individuals, half the number of migrants they'd arrested the week before. Over the holiday season, a cousin of mine went out west to visit his parents, leaving me his car, an elderly Hyundai pushing 175,000 miles that is literally held together with tape. Finally able to deliver food, I joined a WhatsApp group chat called Comidas, Meals in Spanish, that circulated a dizzying blur of spreadsheets each day, specifying those in need of food, diapers, or other supplies. One member posted that on December 23rd, activists would be volunteering with Toop's Family Meal, an established charity, during its annual holiday meal distribution. Toop's Family Meal was launched by the Cajun chef Isaac Toop's to feed needy families during the pandemic. Since then, it has become a local fixture, responding to disasters both natural and man-made, a necessity in a red state whose government seems to operate in two modes, indifference and malevolence. Toop's Family Meal had done heroic work in the aftermath of Hurricane Ida in 2021, and in the summer of 2024, it had stepped up to feed impoverished schoolchildren when Governor Landry turned down federal funding for free lunches. In the end, the state legislature pressured the governor into accepting the funds. Arriving outside Toop's Meadery, his restaurant, I spotted Isaac standing in the back of a refrigerated truck, sorting canvas bags of food. Pale and goateed, he looked vampiric, like one of the New Orleans night people, immortalized by Alan Toussaint. His t-shirt read, "Bruh, I'm tired." Toop's wife Amanda, whom I recognized from Top Chef, sat at a card table set up on the sidewalk and piled high with manila folders. I asked her whether the holiday food delivery was part of the local resistance to federal immigration enforcement. "We have no comment," she replied. Amanda's reticence surprised me, but she perked up when I asked if I could volunteer. She nodded and fetched a printout listing 10 addresses in Mid-City, along with the number of family members in each home and the cell phone number of an adult who lived there. I pulled my cousin's clunker around the corner, popped the trunk, and filled it with canvas bags, careful not to disturb the tape securing the bumper. The addresses had already been arranged according to the most efficient driving route. Just before dropping food at each shotgun house's porch or apartment building's lobby, I sent back-to-back text messages in English and Spanish that read, "My name is Daniel. I am volunteering with Toop's Family Meal. I am leaving the food at your door now. Happy holidays." Most recipients stayed inside until I pulled away and then, after picking up their food, wrote back with a heart emoji, a thumbs up, or a thank you. I couldn't blame them for fearing that I could have been some kind of Trojan horse. On Christmas Eve, I circled back to a house I had visited the day before. Jorge, one of its residents, was out front. Footnote 2. Jorge's name has been changed to protect his identity. He had set up a folding table near the curb and was midway through filleting a redfish, a Christmas present from a friend, he told me, with a curious mix of fishing gear, kitchen gadgets, and power tools. A mechanic by trade, now sheltering in place for the third straight week, he'd fired up a DeWalt power saw to make quick work of the fish's spinal column. It struck me as overkill, but he seemed pleased. In the gutter, The usual New Orleans blend of litter and live oak leaves was topped by a shimmering layer of pink fish scales glinting in the sun. You are listening to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Jorge was a member of the neighborhood Catholic Church just a few blocks away. On a normal Christmas, he'd feel an obligation to attend Mass, but tonight he'd be staying in. His family and friends would have an early Noche Buena dinner consisting of the redfish, the food I'd delivered the day before, and additional groceries sent by his church to parishioners sheltering in place. Ever since the Federales had come to town, Jorge told me he'd been too afraid to attend service. He wasn't alone. After the first Sunday of the surge, the Archbishop of New Orleans issued an official dispensation from the obligation to attend Mass to Catholic families who have chosen not to leave their homes out of fear of encountering immigration enforcement. Just the day before, the Archbishop of Miami had asked President Trump to pause deportation operations during the Christmas season to show a decent regard for the humanity of immigrant families, but the White House declined. I joined the Ojos volunteers fanning out to monitor midnight Mass at churches with large numbers of Latino parishioners. I chose Our Lady of Guadalupe, a progressive church on the edge of the French Quarter that Moreno often attends. In his homily, Father Tony, the Buffalo-born son of Sicilian immigrants, would ask his flock to remember vulnerable immigrant families this Christmas. As I took my seat in the last pew right by the door, an usher handed me a candle. When Mass began, the church's lights cut out, and a jazz trio led us in a sing-along rendition of O Come All Ye Faithful. In the darkened church, my phone lit up repeatedly with WhatsApp messages from Ojos members standing watch over their congregations. At first, I thought all the action might mean the churches were being raided. But as I surreptitiously scrolled on my phone, the messages indicated the opposite. No one was spotting any feds. By the time the services let out, volunteers were speculating that the agents had more or less left town. 3 weeks into the surge, a pattern was becoming evident. The vast majority of raids were taking place on weekdays during normal business hours, not at night, on weekends, or on holidays. One Ojos volunteer quipped that the agents worked banker's hours. Despite the White House's tacit threat to raid churches on Christmas, the agents appeared to be taking the day off. For all their bombast, the ICE and Border Patrol agents seemed to work no harder than any other faceless federal bureaucrats. With ICE struggling to fill its ranks, even with the $55,000 signing bonus and $60,000 in student loan forgiveness offered to new recruits, the top brass was presumably loath to ask agents to work on Christmas. Footnote number 3. A DHS spokesperson clarified that while agents did not technically have Christmas off, it was a slower day. With New Orleans' undocumented community now fully capable of feeding itself while sheltering in place, arrest figures plummeted. During the holiday period, federal immigration agents averaged fewer than 65 arrests per week. Of course, every arrest was someone's tragedy, who'd been separated from his son, a child from her grandmother. But in the aggregate, Operation Catahoula Crunch was, by its own metrics, failing. Even after New Year's Day, as agents got back to work, arrest levels never recovered. Still, activists remained vigilant. On January 6th, I spent the afternoon with Rob, the musician who'd co-led my Ojos training session, as he worked a shift coordinating the region's ICE watchers as a dispatcher. When he wasn't touring, Rob's work was mostly confined to weekend gigs, so ICE's banker's hours suited him. Many of the Ojos volunteers, I was realizing, were New Orleans night people, bartenders, chefs, and musicians, all free during the day to monitor the feds. At his dining room table, in a new home in a scraggly stretch of New Orleans' 7th Ward, Rock toggled between Facebook and WhatsApp on both his phone and laptop. The work was intense. Rob was responsible for monitoring 25 local English language group chats, plus 8 more in Spanish. When actionable information, a sighting of a possible Border Patrol raid, say, appeared in any of the neighborhood chats, it was Rob's responsibility to translate it from Spanish to English or vice versa, then upload it to the region-wide Ojos Alerts chats and the group's 63,000 followers on Facebook. For the most important information, he would post both a text message and a voice memo in both languages. Rob was one of about a dozen dispatchers. All were bilingual, he told me. Slightly more than half spoke English as their first language. The rest were native Spanish speakers. They worked 3-hour shifts arranged through a shared online calendar. For his part, Rob admitted that his Spanish had atrophied a bit since his college years when he'd studied abroad in Cuba, but it was still serviceable. He could even comprehend some Spanish language voice messages at 1.5 speed. But I noticed that when he composed messages in Spanish, he had to mumble the words quietly as he typed, a crutch he didn't need in English. A fair amount of the job, Rob told me, was sorting through messages that were too vague or not germane. One time, he said, someone posted in a chat, ICE activity in the schools in New Orleans. It seemed like a recipe for general panic. Which school, Rob asked. How do you know it's ICE? I looked on as Rob deleted a video clip someone had just posted on the Facebook page after he determined that the footage was 4 weeks old. Then he took down a video of an immigration raid that, from the look of the buildings and local flora, had almost certainly been filmed in Southern California. He was peeved to find that some troll had commented, "Why are you protecting criminals in Louisiana?" But he seemed almost equally annoyed to find the feed clogged up with progressive political grandstanding. The group chats and Facebook page were not for spouting off about politics. They were for providing actionable information that would keep people safe. At around 1:15 in the afternoon, reports of Bovino sightings started pouring into Rob's phone. As usual, the tactical commander was unmasked and surrounded by a phalanx of agents. ICE watchers reported that he and his agents were raiding a strip mall at 20th Street and Williams Boulevard in Kenner. Snapshots of a tan Suburban with Bovino's license plate and photographs of an accompanying black expedition soon appeared in the chat. Rob took down the new plate number to submit it to icecheck.org. "We're always playing catch-up," Rob lamented, as he scrambled to post information about the raid in real time. He was careful to crop out his sources' identifying information. "I don't want to out anyone accidentally," Rob told me. "A screenshot with a phone number would be a problem." Rob uploaded a photo of Bovino in front of a nail salon to the chats and posted it on the Facebook page. In seconds, the photo appeared on my own phone and soon gathered a stream of steaming mad red-faced emojis. Next, Rob dictated a confirmado WhatsApp voice message in Spanish. He began with a timestamp, "Hoy, el 6 de enero." Next, he relayed the same information in a text post, mumbling in Spanish as he composed. He caught himself misspelling Bovino with a second B, as it sounds in some Spanish dialects. Bovino, incidentally, is Spanish for bovine. Ever since I joined Ojos Alerts 2, I'd been amazed by the volunteers' response time, far better than that of the city's problem-plagued 911 system. A minute after an investigando message went out, a member or two would write back that they were heading to the intersection to take a look. Sometimes as soon as 5 minutes later, a volunteer would post a video from the specified location. If agents were present, they would typically leave as soon as they realized they'd been spotted. Most often, despejado messages would follow in quick succession. Discovered almost instantly, this latest raid in Kenner had proved brief and fruitless. Most immigrant-owned businesses in the strip mall, now well-schooled in their constitutional rights, simply locked the agents out. Not a single arrest seems to have been made. Footnote number 4. A DHS spokesperson declined to comment on the details of this operation. There would be no further sightings of Bovino in New Orleans. That same day, the Trump administration announced its largest ever federal immigration crackdown, flooding Minneapolis and St. Paul with roughly 10 times the number of agents dispatched to New Orleans in an effort to target the Somali immigrants whom the president had recently called garbage. As things calmed down in the Ojos chats, Rob speculated that Bovino's cameo in Kenner could be a possible show of force before they focus on Minnesota. The next time Bovino surfaced in public was the following morning at the other end of the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, on the street where an ICE agent had just shot a woman named Renee Nicole Good. The poet and mother of three was not an immigrant. She was a volunteer, like those who had just bested the Border Patrol in New Orleans, and now she was dead. On Saturday, January 10th, protesters gathered in Kenner, as they had every Saturday since the start of Catahoula Crunch. But this rally was different, one of more than 1,000 ICE Out for Good protests taking place across the country in the wake of Good's killing. One of the local protest organizers, Carlos, a naturalized citizen from Honduras, addressed the crowd, gesturing across the street as he spoke. "There are still no kids in the park," he said, "because everyone is still scared." Before he had become a protest organizer, Carlos, a bald and compact building contractor, ran a youth soccer league in Kenner. But since the arrival of the feds, families had grown too terrified to leave home. With no one coming out for games, the league had gone on hiatus. Carlos's work had also dried up. Employees were too scared to show up. For weeks, he devoted himself to food delivery instead, dropping off meals for 45 different families. Some of the kids he'd coached, born in the United States and now old enough to drive, were helping out too. After he finished speaking, Carlos, a bullhorn in hand, led the crowd in a march through the neighborhood. As the procession turned down Martinique Avenue, a stretch of low-slung apartments popular with recent immigrants, residents stepped out onto their porches and balconies. Several raised clenched fists, while one man flashed a V for victory. At the end of Martinique, the march turned toward Williams Boulevard, the site of Bovino's last stand just 4 days before. Many residents were emerging from their homes for the first time in weeks. "People have started coming out. Israel, a naturalized citizen, told me at the rally, but not everybody." There was always the chance that the Border Patrol would return. DHS leadership, subservient to the whims of the president, probably didn't even know themselves. But there was no doubt that the feds had lost the battle in New Orleans. After promising to spend 2 months in town and arrest 5,000 immigrants, Bovino and his Border Patrol pulled out after just 5 weeks and only 560 arrests. Bovino himself would be demoted and sent back to California's sleepy desert borderlands 2 weeks later, in the wake of the killing of Alex Preti, another ICE watcher. But as I followed the harrowing scenes from Minneapolis, it appeared that the feds, too, had learned something in New Orleans, that a mass deportation campaign could never succeed so long as they were bound by the Constitution. So they dispensed with it. Agents were busting down doors without warrants, and federal prosecutors were being pressured to investigate Good's partners' participation in Twin Cities ICE Watch groups. Kristi Noem, the Secretary of Homeland Security, suggested that citizens who recorded agents with their cell phones in public be tried for stalking, a count typically brought only in domestic violence cases. The Department of Justice even charged reporters for reporting on a protest. Statements I'd heard just days before that had sounded self-evident. "Freedom of speech allows us to say, 'I see ICE here,' or 'Don't be somewhere an officer can touch you,' sounded almost quaint now. In our new America, reporters were being deprived of their liberty and activists of their lives. Benjamin Franklin's adage that this was a republic if you can keep it never sounded more ominous. But while elected representatives dithered and elites collaborated, thousands resisted. Most came from the ranks of those casually slandered as ordinary Americans. But what DJs like Alejandra, musicians like Rob, and poets like Renee were doing was extraordinary, and all at great personal risk. From what I witnessed in New Orleans, if the Republic was to endure, it wouldn't be on account of our ostensible leaders stepping up, or even a generalized we the people taking to the streets, though both would be welcome. Rather, our liberties would be saved by the ragtag battalions of night people doing their tireless work, unpaid, unheralded, and largely unseen. Daniel Brook lives in New Orleans. He is the author most recently of The Einstein of Sax, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, Visionary of Weimar Berlin. Next, I'll be reading Dan Pipenbrink's reviews of new books. I used to work for a publisher that accepted unsolicited submissions. Our guidelines, apparently unrevised since the advent of the internet, required authors to mail their manuscripts in hard copy with a self-addressed stamped envelope to ensure their safe return. It fell to me, as an editorial assistant, to stash them deep in a desk drawer in my cubicle. Whenever this drawer began to overflow, I gathered with the other assistants in the conference room for a slush lunch, during which we would tear open the submissions, read aloud passages of notable clownishness, and stuff the return envelopes with form rejection letters, trying not to get ketchup or grease on them. We could clear about 100 submissions in an hour. It was karmically ill-advised to send so many bundles of heartbreak into the world at once, but we had no choice. The manuscripts were overwhelmingly bad, and further armfuls of them were always en route. If there were some unheralded masterpiece hiding among the venison cookbooks, the Ren Fair erotica, the screeds against the Jews, I lacked the patience to pluck it from obscurity. I convinced myself that most writers worth publishing would, eventually, find agents and put their cover letter days behind them. I'm afraid it's true. You need a literary agent in this life. There are more than 1,000 of them in the United States today, and they drink straight from the fire hose of unsolicited prose. They come in for a lot of suspicion. Writers dislike them, often from afar, before successfully signing with one, because they stand like trolls at the bridge between oblivion and acclaim. Editors dislike them because they drive up advances, fuss over cover designs, and undermine writers' trust in the process, which publishers might otherwise exploit for profit. Agents make deals, steely, unromantic deals, and because their work is largely invisible to the public, they would seem to justify the publishing industry at its most commercial, cliquish, and hidebound, a closed loop of Ivy League backslappers, clinching gentlemen's agreements, and chasing trends on the way to their summer homes. Agents calibrate their aesthetic judgments to anticipate and respond to the demands of publishers and the market, becoming administrators of the logic of the corporation, writes Laura B. McGrath in Middlemen, Literary Agents and the Making of American Fiction, Princeton University Press. Nevertheless, many of them are decent people, she contends. They protect writers from a variety of evils, including themselves, and their profession has become central to cultural production. Your favorite novelist, no matter how experimental or anti-establishment, all but certainly has some representative taking a 15% commission out of her advance, negotiating her contracts, talking her up over cocktails, talking her down from the ledge. McGrath, an English professor at Temple University, feels that agents' roles as tastemakers has been overlooked. The first stateside literary agent was Paul Revere Reynolds Sr., a Harvard man and Paul Revere's great-grandson. His blood so blue he could have used it as ink. Reynolds thrived because he persuaded his clients, Cather, Shaw, and Woodhouse among them, that publishing had become too rapacious for them to go it alone. By 1929, his agency commanded $4,000, more than $70,000 in today's dollars, from the Saturday Evening Post for a single short story by Fitzgerald. He eschewed the hard sell and allegedly found it unbecoming to verify an author's royalty statements. Over the ensuing decades, Reynolds' patrician tact was undone by the likes of Scott Meredith, who dared to send a manuscript to multiple editors simultaneously, and Sterling Lord, who helped market the concept of the debut with Kerouac's On the Road, undeterred by the fact that it was his second published novel. Even as publishers merged into behemoths, the more highbrow among them preferred to believe that they put the gentle in genteel. They bristled at the cutthroat competition common in other industries. Generations of agents, therefore, have had to walk a line between bookishness and brutishness. A 1974 profile of Robert Lesher, who repped Dr. Spock and Isaac Bashevis Singer, found him in a brownstone basement with a rust-colored corduroy sofa, an iron wood-burning stove, and on the table a can of Peterson's British pipe mixture, plus two spaniels underfoot. On the other end of the spectrum is Andrew Wiley, nicknamed the Jackal in the Gordon Gekko 80s, who once derided his contemporaries for their small offices covered in dust with dying spider plants in the windows. He became known for poaching clients, extracting heroic sums for their work, and burnishing their reputations abroad. His firm's hundreds of clients include more than 10 Nobel laureates and the Henry Kissinger estate, and he's still so feared that I hope he doesn't read this. McGrath devotes a whole chapter to lunch. This may not be enough. As dolphins bond through synchronized swimming, agents and editors dine out in a ritualized exchange of gossip that sustains, somehow, entire careers. If certain restaurants shutter tomorrow, new books might cease to exist, and this column with them. Candida Dondadio, who took on Pynchon, Cheever, Gaddis, and Roth, "Unlike my pal Portney, I have no complaints," he wrote to her, joked that she sometimes took three lunches a day. Donadio was a regular at the Italian Pavilion, whose gleaming glass atrium was the sun around which publishing orbited in the 70s and 80s. Much has been written about the fabled three martini swill fests of yore, but too little has been made of the eating. Reading about the Pavilion's menu, slim, flat strips of calf's liver sautéed with onions, small pieces of chicken sautéed in a golden pool of garlic butter, superb gravy. I admired the caloric throughput of literary New York in those years. These were the appetites that brought us Gravity's Rainbow and J.R. The best agents compel editors to gamble on uncontainable, unsaleable books like those, or on authors who are neither young, white, nor Brooklynite. Between 2000 and 2022, McGrath writes, more novels were set in New York City than in the other top 30 most populous cities in the United States combined. But agents have to make friends and money. For every visionary among them, there are two more who are unabashedly tribal, with tastes that reflect the industry's homogeneity. Its untenable reliance on folk wisdom, sales tracks, and stories of universality. Publishers will proclaim that a new novel is beyond compare while, internally, comparing it with other profitable novels. Middleman forms a trio with Mark McGurl's The Program Era 2011, which examines the rise of MFAs, and Dan Sinikin's Big Fiction 2023, which follows the effects of publishing's conglomeration. Together, they conjure a wheezing twine factory, the relic of a bygone era, marred with unsightly retrofits from which a good yarn may still occasionally emerge. It's crucial that you really feel that writers are special people, the agent Lynn Nesbitt once said. Otherwise, you might as well be selling toothpaste. To which Mary Kay Ash might have replied, "What's wrong with selling toothpaste?" Ash could move product, regardless of what the product was. Before she founded Mary Kay Cosmetics, the multi-level marketing empire with its notorious phalanx of pink Cadillacs, she claimed to have sold Clover and Salve, an all-purpose ointment, Grolier's child psychology bookshelf, a range of Stanley home products, including mitten dusters, waffle iron brushes, and rubber shampoo capes, and ersatz international trinkets from World Gift, such as German baby spoons and miniature replicas of the Venus de Milo. 6 days a week, she persuaded housewives to host her in their dining rooms, invite their friends, absorb her exuberant spiels as if they were homilies, and become saleswomen themselves. Who was this wonder worker? To find out, Mary Lisa Gavinas had to clear away a lot of debris. As she writes in Selling Opportunity, The Story of Mary Kay, published by Viking, Ash, who died in 2001 at the age of 83, sometimes bent the truth about herself, which can happen when you use your life story to motivate a sales force. She was married 6 times, it seems, but edited out a few husbands in the retelling. And though she'd spent many of her younger years hustling from house to house just to stay afloat, she continued to push the idea that direct selling was a flexible part-time job perfect for the woman who wanted to be there when her kids got home from school, Gavinas writes. The press was happy to accept her as a caricature, with her blonde wig and false lashes, her heels, her diamonds. It could seem as if she'd been born with that poodle in her arms. We've just run out of time, so I'll continue with book reviews next week. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I have been reading from both the March and April 2026 issues. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and looking forward to reading with you again soon.